Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today, we report on plans to satisfy the growing need for electricity in Africa by building nuclear power centers. Many African countries now burn coal or use hydropower or water power to produce electricity. But African leaders say those methods do not create enough power for the continent's growing population. They say nuclear energy is the only way to satisfy Africa's need for electricity.
We expect to conclude the procurement of 9,600 megawatts of nuclear energy.
But activists say there are environmental and security issues with nuclear power, especially in Africa.
There's a lot of conflict and political tension in Africa. A lot of increasing terrorist activity in particularly North and Central Africa. Crime syndicates operating.
Today, we tell about the African nations that want to set up nuclear reactors and the concerns that activists have about nuclear power. Those are our subjects on As It Is. At least three African nations have expressed an interest in nuclear power. Kenya and Nigeria each want to start producing nuclear energy. And South Africa wants to expand its nuclear energy operations. South Africa is the only country south of the Sahara Desert with nuclear power centers. Until now, African nations have depended heavily on coal and hydropower to produce electricity. But those production methods have caused problems, including displacing communities and damaging the environment. The World Bank says fewer than 10% of African homes are connected to electric power lines. This hurts development on the world's poorest continent. The need for electricity has led a growing number of African nations to consider nuclear energy. For many years, some governments and activists have opposed plans to build nuclear reactors in Africa. But in recent years, more and more people have expressed support for nuclear power. The building of nuclear reactors is becoming increasingly popular in both developing and developed countries, including the United States. Kelvin Kim is a South African nuclear physicist. He is also the head of a group called Nuclear Africa. He says Africa cannot continue to depend on water and coal to make electricity.
Africa is very largely fueled with hydropower, and in Africa it's possible to have droughts that last a couple of years. Therefore, it's very risky to build an economy on hydropower. Many are not fortunate enough to have coal and gas, and therefore nuclear is an ideal solution for Africa.
South Africa is the only African nation that has successfully developed nuclear technology. Today, the Coburg Nuclear Power Station produces about 5% of South Africa's electricity. President Jacob Zuma recently said he wants more nuclear power to reduce his nation's dependence on coal.
We expect to conclude the procurement of 9,600 megawatts of nuclear energy.
Kenya and Nigeria say they want to build nuclear power centers to meet rising electricity needs from their growing populations. Kelvin Kim says the power needs are so great that traditional methods of producing power cannot meet the demand the way nuclear power can.
They need to double electricity consumption immediately and then double it again and again and again and again for their people.
Critics of nuclear energy say it is not always safe. They note the nuclear disasters at Fukushima in Japan and Chernobyl in the former Soviet Union. But those concerns may not be heard over the rising demand for electricity. Experts say it will be years before African nations can meet their energy needs, either with nuclear power or other sources. Experts say more than 600 million people in Africa are not connected to electrical power lines. They think nuclear power will solve the problems of the growing continent. But some activists are worried about the cost, environmental damage, and possible security issues. Dominique Gilbert lives near the Pelindaba Nuclear Research Center in South Africa. From the 1960s to the 1980s, government researchers developed nuclear bombs there. Ms. Gilbert helped launch a group called the Coalition Against Nuclear Energy, South Africa. She is worried that the government is moving too quickly on its plans for more nuclear power without telling people about the risk.
Unfortunately, there hasn't been that much information spread around the general public about the dangers of nuclear and certainly the costs of nuclear. So it's not just health, but we believe it will bankrupt this country. It's totally and utterly unaffordable.
Dominique Gilbert says South Africa has done little to study the effects of nuclear energy on communities near nuclear power centers. And she says the government has failed to educate people about the possible dangers of nuclear power. Activists around the world have been worried about the risk of radiation exposure for many years. But some experts believe nuclear fuel creates fewer health risks than the burning of coal. South Africa burns a great deal of coal to produce electricity. We heard from Kelvin Kim earlier in the program. He is a nuclear physicist and head of the group Nuclear Africa. He says people have been given misleading information about the safety of nuclear power.
Of all the energy sources that there are, nuclear has shown itself to be the safest. And it's quite amazing how much of a public misperception there is about this, that there's been absolute scare tactics developed.
But perhaps the biggest concern about a nuclear-powered African continent is a lack of security in many African nations. Activists are worried that nuclear reactors are likely targets of attack. Dominique Gilbert is especially worried about the possible theft of nuclear materials for weapons.
There's a lot of conflict and political tension in Africa, a lot of increasing terrorist activity in particularly North and Central Africa, crime syndicates operating.
Knox Msimbenzi is the managing director of the Nuclear Industry Association of South Africa. He admits there are risks of building nuclear reactors in Africa, but he believes those risks can be controlled. And that's our program for today. It was based on stories from reporters Anita Powell and Peter Cox in Johannesburg. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting from VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington.
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Researchers are using new methods to aid investigations into deadly strikes by pilotless planes called drones. The United Nations wants independent investigations into drone attacks. They estimate that there were 3 times as many civilian deaths from drones last year as the year before. But it is difficult to know the effect on civilians because the attacks are often in lightly populated areas. A recent investigation found that drone strikes in Pakistan killed 2,000 people during a 10-year period. The information was given to the United Nations. Scientists from Goldsmiths, University of London, and SITU Research in New York are trying to learn more. They have been gathering evidence to create 3D moving images of drone attacks. They call this process forensic architecture. Susan Shupley is the lead researcher from Goldsmiths. She says forensic architecture answers an important question in the debate over drones.
What does drone warfare actually produce as a kind of lived reality on the ground?
Ms. Shupley and her team use satellite images of places before and after an attack. They also use reports from witnesses, local maps, and other information. The goal is to help investigations into drone strikes that happened in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Gaza, and Somalia. The scientist identified 37 drone strikes in those areas.
It counters a certain perception that there's very little that we can know about these strikes that often take place in what are considered to be remote regions of the world.
The research will be included in a United Nations report on the legality of drone operations. Kat Craig is the legal director for the charity organization Reprieve. She says the United States and other drone users have offered little information about such operations.
The entire drone program is shrouded in secrecy. There is no clarity or transparency about the targeting process, about the decisions that are made. There's no transparency when mistakes are made and no accountability to that effect.
Douglas Murray is the associate director of the Henry Jackson Society, a policy research group based in London. He says drones are the best choice of bad choices to try to deal with radicals and terrorists.
If you're objecting to drone strikes, then you have to my mind, explain how else you deal with this problem of radicals and terrorists existing in these areas. Either you send in large numbers of forces, or you do drone strikes, or you've got to do something else. What is the something else?
The United Nations says U.S. drone attacks on Pakistan appear to have decreased. None have been reported so far in 2014. But the UN says drone strikes have increased in Yemen. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to This Is America. I'm Steve Ember. Today on our program, we take you on a trip through the northeastern state of Vermont, part of the area known as New England. Each fall, people travel to Vermont to see the colorful autumn leaves. In winter, people come to ski and snowboard in the mountains. And in the warmer months, they go on river rafting trips and enjoy camping and other outdoor activities. Come along with us as we visit the Green Mountain State. Only about 600,000 people live in Vermont. That makes it the second least populated state in the country after Wyoming. And the state is small not just in population. Vermont is 45th out of the 50 states in territory. It has just 24,000 square kilometers of land. In addition, it has almost 950 square kilometers covered by water. What Vermont lacks in size, it makes up for in beauty. It is known as the Green Mountain State. The name comes from the Green Mountains, which divide the state up and down the center. In fact, the name Vermont comes from the French Vermont, meaning Green Mountain. Along the northern border of Vermont is the Canadian province of Quebec. Vermont is bordered by Massachusetts on the south, New Hampshire on the east, and New York on the west. A century ago, forests covered less than one-third of Vermont. Trees were being cut down for farmland and forest products faster than they could be replaced. That has changed. Today, forests cover more than three-fourths of the state. But Vermont is known not just for its natural resources, it is also known for a strong sense of independence. During colonial times, Vermonters fought off territorial claims by bordering colonies. Ethan Allen led most of the fighting, with help from his brother Ira and an armed group known as the Green Mountain Boys. Ethan Allen became a hero of the American Revolution. But Vermont was not among the 13 colonies that declared their independence from England in 1776. Vermont did become the 14th state, however, when it joined the Union in 1791. And it became the first state to declare slavery illegal. By 1777, Vermonters had written their own constitution, declaring themselves free and independent. Their constitution also made slavery illegal in Vermont. The capital of Vermont is Montpelier, in the center of the state. But the largest city is Burlington, on the shores of Lake Champlain. Lake Champlain and the fertile Champlain Valley are in the northwestern part of Vermont. They are named for Samuel de Champlain. The French explorer arrived at the lake in 1609. Burlington is busy and fast-growing. It is also home to one of the state's oldest and largest schools, the University of Vermont. The university was established with a financial gift from Ira Allen in 1791. Vermont has strong roots in education. Emma Willard was teaching in Vermont when she became an activist for women's rights in education. Martin Henry Freeman, the first black college president in the United States, was born in Rutland, Vermont. And the philosopher John Dewey was from Burlington and attended the University of Vermont. Dewey is considered the father of modern progressive education in the United States. Dairy farming is the main agricultural industry in Vermont, but the travel industry and manufacturing are also major employers. General Electric manufactures airplane engine parts in Rutland and North Clarendon, Vermont. IBM makes computer equipment at a factory in Essex Junction. And the computer software developer IDX Systems is based in Burlington. Food producers also help drive the Vermont economy. Local companies include Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. The Cold Hollow Cider Mill is the largest producer of fresh apple cider in the northeastern United States. More than 300,000 people visit the mill each year to see how fresh apples get crushed into cider. Vermont is the leading producer in the United States of another liquid that many people enjoy, maple syrup. The sweet golden syrup is made from the sap harvested in spring from Vermont's sugar maple trees. The four grades of Vermont maple syrup differ somewhat in color and taste, but they can all be enjoyed on a morning meal of pancakes and eggs. Community support for local farming is strong in Vermont. Burlington and its surrounding communities, for example, hold local farmers' markets several times a week. Many people who sell goods at these markets are members of a cooperative farming program supported by the Intervale Center. This is a nonprofit group that helps develop land and farm-based businesses in and around the city of Burlington. One of its most successful operations is the Farm Incubator Program. Through the program, the Intervale Center provides low-cost land to new and established farmers. In addition, members share equipment, business services, and technical assistance. Each incubator farm is required to use organic growing methods. Intervale does not support dairy farming, but Shelburne Farms near Burlington does. The nonprofit Working Farm is one of the biggest and oldest cheese producers in Vermont. Its award-winning cheddar is made from the milk of brown Swiss cows. Shelburne Farms also supports community education programs. Each year, more than 100,000 people visit the farm, which overlooks Lake Champlain. Lila Vanderbilt Webb founded Shelburne Farms in 1886. The Vanderbilts are an important family in American history. She was the granddaughter of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who built his wealth in shipping and railroads. One of the best-known companies in Vermont is Ben & Jerry's. It sells ice cream around the country with names like Cherry Garcia and Chunky Monkey. The British and Dutch company Unilever bought Ben & Jerry's in 2000. Ben & Jerry's even has a small graveyard with markers for flavors that have been retired. The graveyard is behind its factory in the small town of Waterbury. Also in Waterbury is a store operated by the Vermont Teddy Bear Company. Toy bears sold in the United States, called teddy bears, are commonly made in China. But the company says It hand-produces the only bear made in America and guaranteed for life, and it ships its products around the world. The bears can come specially dressed, for example, for events like weddings, birthdays, or holidays. No matter what road you take to the Ben & Jerry's factory or the Vermont Teddy Bear store, chances are you will cross a covered bridge. Bridges protected by structures that look like barns represent historic small-town America. There are just over 100 covered bridges remaining in Vermont. Most were built in the 1800s. Our trip to Vermont would not be complete without a stop at Huntington Gorge. This is a deep, narrow cut in the earth. Water from the Huntington River flows through the gorge at a high rate of speed. Huntington Gorge is another reminder to visitors that nature has made its mark on Vermont. It is perhaps the best example of water sculpture in Vermont. It is truly a natural work of art. A series of deep drops along the gorge end in pools of dark blue, green, and clear water. Smooth white rock formations force the water through the path of the gorge. Rainbows of color fill the air, along with the music of bubbles and rushing water. And speaking of music, if you've been wondering about the song we've been playing from time to time, perhaps you'd like to imagine a large, full moon rising over the Vermont landscape, as songwriters John Blackburn and Carl Susdorf must have done.
Pennies in a stream, falling leaves, a sycamore, moonlight in Vermont, icy finger waves, ski trails on a mountainside, snow light. Telegraph cables, they sing down the highway, and tread in the road. People who meet in this romantic setting are so hypnotized by the lovely evening summer breeze.
This song became Vermont's unofficial state song. It's unusual in that the lines do not rhyme, and it doesn't seem to matter one little bit. By the way, Vermont doesn't really have a lot of sycamore trees, or meadowlarks for that matter. John Blackburn, who wrote the words, can be excused. He was actually from Ohio. Margaret Whiting recorded this classic version of the song the same year it was written, 1944. I'm Steve Ember, hoping you've enjoyed our visit to the Green Mountain State and even some of that Vermont moonlight with us, and inviting you to join us again next week for another This Is America from VOA Learning English.